I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. Very delighted today to welcome Dr. Greg Cuzzona to Conversing. Greg and I have known each other for many, many years. We're good friends, and I have greatly admired him as a person, as a disciple, but also in many of these years, he has been particularly focused on issues of faith and science. And it's really that brings us into the conversation today. He is currently a lecturer in religious studies and humanities at Chico State University, and he's the co-founder of scienceforthechurch.org, which really offers resources for Christian congregations to integrate mainstream science into their ministries. He's written some very valuable books. His most recent one is entitled Science and Religion in the United States, Past, Present, and Future. And his next to last book is a book called Mere Science and Christian Faith, Bridging the Divide with Emerging Adults. Greg, I'm just delighted that you're here and excited about this conversation.
Well, it's really good to be part of this podcast. It is one of my very favorite podcasts, so thanks for the opportunity.
You come with a lot of rich educational background from being a graduate of UC Berkeley and Princeton Seminary and the Graduate Theological Union, all part of your background. You've also been deeply involved in BioLogos, which is an amazing organization that Francis Collins, who we'll talk a little bit more about later, the head of the NIH, National Institutes of Health. And that really is the place that I want to begin in a certain way, because there's an abstraction to the conversation around faith and science, which I think is extremely important. And we're going to come to that a little bit later. But let's start at the front end. When I think about the COVID virus that we're facing and the challenges that are unfolding right now, it's been so interesting to listen to the way that faith and science has again appeared as one of those places of both intense, even hostile debate, where the anger that has gone back and forth between religious respondents to the crisis and scientific responses to the crisis have exposed once again some of the big pieces of the conversation that's gone on for at least 2.5 centuries. It's an amazingly important conversation, and it shows itself in ways that I think your work historically in your most recent book and your work in trying to communicate to an emerging adult population reflects that that conversation is by no means over and that it's really important. So let's just begin by having you kind of give us a snapshot. As you have been paying attention to the COVID virus coverage and the faith-science tensions and discussions, what has stood up for you?
I think with the outbreak of the coronavirus, we've seen in the United States so many of the key elements that have been part of the relationship of religion and science in our country. And I think of those as cultural forces, if nothing else. And as you mentioned in this last book, Negotiating Science and Religion in America, I really was able to understand the history of that relationship. But you see, you know, the conflict that has come out to some degree between religious people, especially in our country, because we're predominantly Christian, certain Christian responses that are conflictual with science. But then you've seen the amazing collaboration, which is such a part of our history as well and of the present day. And so when I think about, you know, what is God doing about the coronavirus, there are two words that come to mind. Francis Collins. He embodies so much of what is the best of the way I think God is using the body of Christ to respond right now.
Right. Say more about that, because not everyone is fully acquainted with him. He is an absolutely remarkable exemplar. I agree.
Yes. So as you mentioned, I was so privileged to be asked to be part of the advisory council for BioLogos, which is the organization he founded 10 years ago, 11 years ago, excuse me, this March, to bring together evangelical Christian faith with the insights of science. And immediately thereafter, he was then appointed to be the head of the National Institutes of Health, you know, by President Obama. And it's interesting to point out, which this is something that says a lot about his character, his position was continued by President Trump in 2016. So anybody that works both for the Obama and the Trump administration has got to be an extraordinary person. And he's a person who was homeschooled, not because of a particularly religious orientation or values of his parents, but because they were kind of hippies and they homeschooled him in an artsy kind of way. He then went on to do work in physics. He got a PhD and then did an MD and is both kind of a theoretical scientist, but also a practical physician. He headed up the Human Genome Initiative, which produced the results in 2000, the full mapping of the human genome, which is probably one of the greatest scientific discoveries of the 21st century. And then, as I said, he was head of the NIH just after he started BioLogos. So his ability to speak as both a really top scientist, but also as a physician in this time is just such a great example for how Christians can respond. I mean, obviously not everybody's Francis Collins, but we can look to people like him and the kind of science and the kind of dedication he brings. So just this week, he did a podcast with BioLogos talking about the coronavirus, talking about what is the current status of the outbreak of COVID-19 in our country, talking about how we respond as Christians. And literally, Mark, every time I see him or hear him, it just brings tears to my eyes. I really have very few heroes in my life, and he's definitely one of those people that just has a heroic stature for me. That to me is how he fits in to this time as such an example, a shiny example.
So let's hold these two things together. On the one end, I would absolutely agree, is Francis Collins. And on another place on the spectrum are the people who have done what so often some outspoken Christian voices do. They immediately label it as an act of God in some way, usually as an act of judgment against some particular aspect of human experience or identity or some moral failures. So there's that response that sees COVID-19 as a judgment on the world. Another group of people see it as an opportunity to elevate God's power in almost like a Baal-like way, where they're going to push for the demonstration that as a body of believers, they can still gather in these days and still be free from COVID-19 because, as I've heard it said on many of these interviews, because the blood of Jesus will cover the congregation. And that science is to lead us toward the language of man, not the practices and vision of God. So you have on one end overt hostility, where these are fighting lines, where faith is over and against science on one end. And then on the Francis Collins end, you see the benefit and evidence of this integration, which for him comes, as he himself admits, not always easily, but deeply and profoundly, right? So just talk about that spectrum and what it causes you, in light of your own historical studies, to think about the state of the faith science debate. What's happening? Is it the same as it's always been since the Scopes trial, or is it somehow different?
I mean, I think it's hard to summarize the fullness of, you know, what's happening in the United States at any one time. I'm not trying to like diffuse the answer to the question, but I'll speak to it as best I can. And I think what's really significant about this time is that, you know, the coronavirus, it's so real, and it's becoming more and more real. We're now in that period in which we're all beginning to know somebody who's either died or been infected by the coronavirus. So in that sense, the felt need for how science and faith can interact with this crisis, a very real thing. And I think that's different. I think that's one of the differences. It intensifies a lot of the feelings that we have. And I would say that Americans have been responding well to the science that's been presented. One of the most respected voices is Anthony Fauci, Tony Fauci, who works actually underneath the supervision of Francis Collins. And so I think science is being well received. I think there are a lot of voices, Christian and otherwise, that are saying the science is really important. And so in that way, I think there is a uniqueness about this. There's a kind of intensification of everything right now. Everything is just amplified. It's not being suppressed and compressed. It's being exacerbated at this point.
Exaggerated, yeah.
And at the same time, you know, we see what's been going on in our country that, unfortunately, somehow being a person of faith is decided to be whatever faith means. It means whatever we can't understand in terms of natural causation, right? So science studies the causes in the natural world, and to understand those is somehow against being a person of faith. It's almost like faith only can exist in the absence of knowledge, of the knowledge of natural forces. And I think that view of faith is what is becoming even more apparently anti-science. So, you know, when we post on our Facebook feed for Science for the Church, or when, again, this recent Francis Collins YouTube video was coming out, it's, you know, live, people were putting in Psalm 91 says that we are protected by God's wings. And I guess I wouldn't ever make those two things different, meaning protection by God's wings and the development of, you know, an antibody or antidote, excuse me, or social distancing. Those are all related in my understanding, right? And so I think it's when we see those things as different, as not just different, but antithetical as Christians, is when we get into problems. Just to put it another way, I just heard on NPR recently, a pastor from the Washington, D.C. area saying, we've got two commandments that Jesus highlighted, you know, the commandment to love God, and we do that in our worship services, but we also have the commandment to love neighbor. And by practicing social distancing and not having worship services, we are being sure we are undergirding that part of the commandment to love neighbor.
Right.
And I just think it seems just to be endemic to how we do our Christian witness, to see science as legitimate and significant, and also to practice things that are good neighborly practices. So I think it all depends, how do we see science? Is it something that's a hand of God, God speaking and helping us find healing? Or is it something that we have to be antithetical to and find another way to do our work? And I'm very much of the perspective, which is a incredibly long history in the Christian church, that science is a way that God is working in the world.
Yeah, the language that Francis Collins uses as the title of his own personal story, as well as reflections of his conversion in the place of faith and science, is called the language of God. And it's along the same lines as you're arguing. At the time of the Reformation and really before that, the conversation turned around phrases like the book of nature, sometimes over and against the book of scripture. And I think that what it partly reveals is the way that the material world and the spiritual world are wrestled with. And some people make them oppositional and have certainly by the early 20th century, you have a very strong eschatological conversation about the fact that in the end, it will only be the spiritual realities that will endure and nothing about the material realities. Whereas I would say the arc of a great deal of theological reflection that's been meaningful and grounded in the scriptures as well has been to say, no, there will be both a material and physical reality, a new creation, but a new physical creation that will manifest the full spiritual reality of God's purposes and design in ultimate and final terms, right? But depending on where you stand on that discussion, you have really, really different conclusions about whether you approach a material reality like disease and say that is itself a spiritual attack, not a physical attack. And then depending on what you think God does with physical reality, you have a really different set of consequences from that. And some people stand inside Christian traditions that lead them to say that should just be rejected. And others say, no, that should be deeply embraced. And that, as you say, God is using the language of science as the language of God, as a language which accompanies our understanding of the character and purposes of God's justice and righteousness and goodness and beauty.
Right. Yeah. I mean, honestly, since we have a long history and you were my pastor when I first became a Christian, my college pastor at Berkeley, I learned a lot of this from you, you know, also from Earl Palmer at First Presbyterian Church, that creation is good. For that reason, we don't put the body and the concerns of the body as somehow against the spirit, because that's ultimately a Gnostic way of looking at things. That the only thing that's important is the spirit and the body's unimportant. But as we celebrate Easter, we think about, not just think about, we confess that Jesus was raised in the body and that we are going to be given new bodies. So that whole thing that God makes of this psychosomatic body-soul unity is all important. And I'm thankful that that was something that has been part of my Christian life for a long time, even before I really did a lot of work with science and faith, that it's actually a theological conviction. And so when we're concerned with how do we care for the bodies of people, we're concerned for them as concrete selves, which is also related, I think, again, learned from the ministries that you and I both know very well, and again, to which you pointed me early in my discipleship, that culture and faith are really important to connect with one another, because God isn't somehow floating outside of being part of human life and human culture. And so when I look at science and faith in this time, in the coronavirus time, or, you know, more broadly in other concerns like global climate change or the evolution creation discussion or psychology and faith, I look at it as a way of saying, how can these languages of faith and science come together? How can culture and faith come together? Because that's so much a part of what my Christian life has been about. And I'm really thankful for that. And it's hard for me not to think that way, to be honest.
Well, it is so interesting about how these things are examples of social location, right? I mean, I tried as a pastor to affirm these things for the reasons that you've articulated, and that becomes part of your social location, which I think you've now tried to examine and test, and all of your work and research and scholarship has been given to sort of keep pushing on those pieces. But there is a kind of foundational piece that has to do with your social location, where your ability to internalize and make sense of that felt like it fit you. What strikes me often in these debates is people live in different social locations, clearly. And in those social locations, really different assumptions can exist, in which the tensions of a material spiritual life are held in really, really different ways. Yeah. And that then emerges in a response to these kinds of debates. And it feels as open and closed to many people who hold a radically anti-materialist view, I would say, as it can for people who hold a pro-materialist view of a spiritual Christian vision of the world.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And that's actually one of the things that's really been helpful in trying to do this faith and science work, is recognize that the way that we come to these conversations in churches is so different, right? And so if you have the sense that the only way I know if God works is if there's no natural explanation, then I'm going to always be looking for a non-natural explanation, an explanation which has nothing material about it. You know, it's that story of, the doctors told me that the cancer was never going to be cured. I had my prayer group pray. My brother was healed of cancer. That just showed that God worked. Now, that is absolutely possible in my view of Christian faith, that God can heal. But the story could be just as good that the doctor said that, you know, this round of treatment is going to work, and God worked through that round of treatment. You know, those two things are not antithetical. And to just get a little bit theological that may glaze everybody's eyes over, even if they're not watching something with this podcast, it's really dual causation that, you know, this is Thomas Aquinas' idea brought through many Christian thinkers, that to say an action has natural causes, in other words, that we heal somebody through the work of medical science or through psychology in terms of talk therapy or psychotherapy of other sorts or whatever, that doesn't mean that God isn't also working, because God works through the material world. So those two causes are not antithetical to one another. Everything we see has God as at least the first cause of creating things and sustaining things at all times. And I'm happy to have the conversation and the discovery be one of, this is something God did uniquely. And it's maybe like the resurrection of Jesus Christ at Easter, that is a divine act, right? We wouldn't say that came out of some sort of natural thing that was going to happen anyway. But there are almost all other things that we see where God works. God does it through natural action. If you don't mind, if I add one thing about social location, which I find really important for this conversation of science and faith, I know it's something, this is a topic that's important to you, is the topic of race is also a part of how science and faith are understood. And one of the things that we've tried to do in the different work that I've done, like when I did the project Science and Theology for Emerging Adult Ministries through Fuller, there was a real interest in bringing in non-traditional locations for faith and science work. And there are just different questions that are brought from those locations. And there may be, for very good reasons, a resistance to science, which isn't this theological side per se of God has to work, quote, supernaturally, but that science has been used against my group, as it were, for very deleterious reasons. For example, I think of the Tuskegee syphilis experiments that were done on African Americans without their consent, right? It brings a different tone to what how science and faith are engaged with. That's been part of the conversation I've been trying to pursue as well.
Because they were victims of science.
Because they're victims of
as opposed to just being another group of people appropriately tested. They were actually subjugated to an unknown experiment, which was their undoing. I mean, it was the end of their lives in many cases.
Right.
And it's a profoundly different social location. Well, I think one of the social location changes that's going on that everybody is talking about these days, even in non-COVID times, are the arrival of both millennials and Gen Z people who come at these questions also for a very different set of generational reasons. And this is part of what you've been trying to address in the book that came out in 2018. So tell us a little bit about that. How does this conversation change in its angles and issues when you think about people in those generations?
I'd love to start in talking to my iGen or Gen Z students at Chico State and tell them that I did not use a computer until my master's program. I grew up, 5 miles away from Jobs and Wozniak creating the Apple computer, but I could not afford a computer until much later. And they just look at me like, I literally came from another planet, right? You know, I'm in my late 50s, so that gives a sense of the timing. And I've mentioned this because all of my students are digital natives in a way that I'm not, which affects how they understand science and technology and faith. So I'll just go through all those three in just a sentence or two. So, I mean, technology has always been a part of this particular generation's life, you know, those born from 1996 or later, like my younger daughter, Lizzie. Science, I think, is really bound up with technology for them, and it's really hard for those to be distinguished, even though scholars like to do that. But I think there's generally a sense of a strong trust in science. I was talking at one point in interviews I've done with 20-somethings, late teens, undergrads, and I asked Giovanni, how do you relate faith and science? And he said, well, I see them as different languages, but if they do come into conflict, I'd rather choose science. And I think that's a standard way that I see of this generation understanding science. It has a certain kind of a reliability that faith does not. And then I think religion or faith, I would just say, is a bit of a, I call it a Spotify spirituality instead of an LP religion, you know? So an LP, which is thankfully coming back, so I don't have to do a bit of a time warp moment, but you know, you listen to one artist, one side, one sequence, and then you turn it over and you listen to side B, whereas almost nobody listens to music that way anymore. And it's an assortment of different artists, different music that creates the way we hear, you know, what comes through, you know, our speakers.
Playlists,
exactly. Yeah. And they can change and they have different curated playlists we listen to. And I think that's the way a lot of people are looking at religion. It's a Spotify religion. It's a digital streaming religion. And even Christians, I think, are doing a little more of this. So all of that has affected this conversation of faith and science. And that's also made, I think, this last part of religion and the ability of technology to give us an understanding of various religious inputs. It's given Gen Z and millennials a resistance to affiliating so that when, as many people know, when people are asked, you know, what religious affiliation are you? I think it's now 40% of 18 to 30-year-olds are checking the box, none of the above. And that makes it really significant for how we have this conversation. So that when the Barna Group did a survey of the six reasons that this demographic is not affiliating, one of the top six reasons was that they perceived the church was anti-science. So because I really care about the church, because I grew up outside of the church and was brought in because of the way the gospel was brought in a message that I could understand, I'm concerned about those 40% of our emerging generations that are resisting the message of the gospel because the church is seen as anti-science. And so one of the reasons that our team with Science for the Church is trying to help churches become more science-friendly is for the future of the church, really, to help craft and articulate a message that will be more enduring, more winsome for this emerging generation.
I'm Mark Laberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. I think it's really profound, actually, to hear those statistics when I've come across them, because they really do point to living in and holding a different mental frame for reality, right? It's a picture of things that are just not framed like they would have been when I was growing up or when you were growing up, where there was a sense that you were choosing to be a person who identified with religion, perhaps or not. I didn't until I was in college. Then it also had to do with the question of, where is science in that map? And because I grew up in a context in which science was very highly affirmed and given great validation, and because I actually loved science and went down that road in a lot of my own studies, I was drawn into that world with an affirmation. Then when I eventually became a Christian, it felt as though these things converged in ways that became really profound in validating both and. But I know what you're describing is exactly right. So when I was bringing up earlier the press's coverage of all that's going on in churches that are being hostile, it seems to me, to science, I'm concerned about the people in those churches for their own particular and personal reasons. But I suppose more broadly concerned that the backwash of that kind of conversation, especially as it just occasionally splatters itself on the screen of whatever media we might be following, just reinforces what you're describing, that it really has to be a choice, that it has to be a choice towards science. And if that means against religion, then so be it, because I couldn't think of living in a world that is not pro-science, many would say, right? And therefore, if the paradigm is it must be a choice, then there's no choice, because I'm clearly going to make the science choice, not the faith choice. That is what is so tragic to me right now, because it feels like the way it's posed drives that wedge in such a terrible way. It has terrible long-term consequences.
You said it perfectly. I'm always thinking about that 18-year-old that comes to Berkeley like I did, or to Chico State or wherever, and is just walking around Sproul Plaza or the free speech area in Chico State, and they have no idea that the gospel could be relevant or interesting for their life. And one of the reasons is if they've heard about it, they've heard it to be something that invalidates so many things that they hold to be true. So that's, for me, the deep driving force and why I'm really interested in emerging adults and how we can articulate this. Also, I mean, the other side of it is those kids that grow up in churches like you're talking about that are anti-science. And I've heard numerous stories. I'm thinking of one of a person who grew up in a pretty conservative church, learned young earth creationism, then went to a top school. I think it was Cambridge or Oxford in England, and learned geology and just saw the importance of the scientific paradigm, which includes evolutionary thought, and literally apparently said, how can I believe the gospel, which was bound up with people who taught me terrible science, and rejected his faith? And I can tell you, I've heard that story more times than I'd like to repeat, because it troubles me a great deal.
Right. It's a fracturing of God's creation, really. It's a separation of the way God has made the world in a way that is just so painful.
Absolutely. Because I was a pastor for so long, and I'm still an ordained Presbyterian pastor, actually ordained to do the work I do now, to be honest, which is really exciting for me, that I can care about my friends who are pastors. And I know how difficult it is right now to be a pastor. Even before COVID-19, it was really challenging. And so I keep wanting to help churches to the degree that I can to understand the message that will be, again, winsome. I love that kind of idea that it's going to win people over, or at least be available for consideration. You know what I mean? Like, it's a viable question. Is Jesus Christ someone that you can commit your life to? And how do you articulate that? I think one way is to have that message be science informed and science friendly. So I care about that.
Right. You know very well that when Friedrich Schleiermacher wrote his book, The Christian Faith, he dedicated it, or intended to have it reach, what he referred to as the cultured despisers of the church. And I think that that's the space in which the faith science dialogue, from my point of view, matters the most. Because if you don't address the culture despises of the church in a way that says that they stand inside a number of values, they stand inside Enlightenment values, they stand inside, especially in a Western tradition, individual values, but they also stand inside the legitimacy of logic and reason and evidence-based knowledge, and stand inside the context of discovery and the affirmation of a material world. All those things, which I want to say isn't necessarily easily won ground, because it has to be thought through and argued through, and all kinds of writers, philosophers, theologians, pastors, and others have been working on those issues, of course, for millennia. But in a deeper sense, in the moment, it feels to me like the work that you're doing when you are writing a book like the one that you did for millennials and Gen Z is really targeting the culture despisers of a certain generation who really think it's impossible to imagine how the possibilities of faith could ever be really understood or known, or let alone embraced. Yes. And I like, as you have said, this idea of not demanding it as though in a kind of causational way, I'm going to line out the reasons and therefore you must believe. That's not the approach that you're taking, and it's not the approach that I think is really needed in this time. What I do think is needed is a compelling opportunity to hear the evidence and to understand its implications and to hold its mysteries as well as its claims with an openness and an engagement that doesn't rebuff the legitimate reasons that many might find themselves culture despisers of the faith. That is, to me, a legitimate posture for somebody to be in, that they would reject the faith because of various intellectual and other kinds of reasons. But your witness, and I think the witness of the church in relationship to these issues, has to do with how we can find a way of giving language to these concerns that really honors the legitimacy of human questions and of generational questions and of the claims of science and so forth in a way that get meaningfully understood and reflected on in relationship to this critical reality that shapes our lives every day, which is also science.
Right. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think of some of the motivation for writing Mere Science and the Christian Faith was exactly to address culture despisers. And one of those I remember in my undergraduate was a professor of comparative literature that I really liked. She was from Switzerland, Friederike Hassauer. And I liked what she was teaching so well about the French Enlightenment and this whole emergence of secular thought that I said, would you be willing to have dinner with my parents? I'd love to meet one of my professors. And my mother, who had a German background, you know, liked anybody who had German-Swiss connections. So we went to Upstart and Crow, which was on Shattuck, I think, right in Berkeley. We had our burger right around all the books there. And we were having this wonderful conversation, Tom and Ruth Cusona, my parents, and Friederike Hassauer, my professor. And I had just become a Christian a few months before, if I'm not mistaken, maybe a year before. And I was making a very broad statement that, you know, I had some faith in God, nothing really very specific. And she stopped in that very direct way that the German speaking world often has and said, I wish I could do the accent, but it was like, how can you believe in God after human Kant? You know, I thought, right in the middle of my hamburger with my parents, are you kidding me? But that was exactly the kind of person that Schleiermacher is talking about. And at Cal, I love Cal, so this is not something against, you know, UC Berkeley, but that was very standard line that I would hear. You know, at this point, and this back in the 80s, how can you believe in God in light of science? Because Hume and Kant were seen as coming out of the scientific paradigm of the Enlightenment as philosophers. And I'm really wanting students in this book to be able to say, no, we can have a really solid faith, a really firm faith that, you know, is part of this world. And maybe you've even been a person who has had that kind of culture despiser approach. And let's look at this again, at least because the scientific revolution occurred in a Christian context, you know, in Europe. And because of that, Christians have been a part of the development of modern science as we know it since its inception. And then, you know, I think the other part of it that you just touched on so beautifully was when we talk about strategy, I've come to understand, you know, we don't engage arguments. We engage people we respect and their arguments. And so one of the ways to create change, whether it's a change from a kind of science unfriendly faith, science rejecting faith, or a atheistic faith that is seen as rejecting a science unfriendly faith, if you can get both of those sides, right? It's because we are engaged with people who are thoughtful and people who embody values that we really trust. And so part of that cultural engagement, and even with all its questions, is to say, I believe in Jesus Christ. That is where my life finds its rock. But that doesn't mean that I therefore know every answer to every question. And I recognize that I have a deep sense that Christ is going to help me resolve questions that I have that science, technology, and other issues pose. I think because of that, we don't have to solve those questions to have a viable witness for the culture despisers mm-hmm. or those affected by the rejection that culture presents to Christian faith. Mm-hmm. It's really, I think, that sense of openness, that sense of being able to question and explore, that faith seeks understanding, you know, as Anselm said, questing after understanding. That is something that I think also is important in just the strategy and the approach of how we have a science-friendly faith. And as you can tell, there's a lot of passion for that. That's why I wrote the book for this generation, because I think there is increasingly this conception that science and faith, especially Christian faith, cannot go together.
Well, I do think we're living in a moment right now, partly because of the coronavirus, that opens up an opportunity for new conversations. And it sometimes opens it up out of personal pain and loss, grief, anger at God for allowing, as it were, such a disease to even exist, let alone to take some loved one or to threaten their life or well-being or their job or the economy or all of the things that are being upended by this. So some have a visceral reaction against God in the context of this scientific and material battle. But then there's others who are finding themselves that I've spoken to who are talking about a new kind of readiness in their life to re-examine what is actually foundational. What are the assumptions of how they have seen themselves and their neighbor and the material world and how they want to respond to vulnerability and weakness and unknowing rather than to be overly stuck in a certain sort of smaller box of confident knowing where they think they have all of their hands on all the necessary levers until they simply don't. And a moment like this just strips all of us of any illusion that we have final control over something. This invisible force that could be even in our body and unrecognizable to us could still actually be passed on and bring very dangerous consequences to the people that are around us. That strips us of a kind of human illusion of power and the capacity to control our destiny. How do you interact with that? And what would you say are some of the questions that you would encourage people that are freshly open at this time to examining some of these questions in light of the challenges that we're facing with coronavirus? What are some of the questions that you think people should explore if that's the place that they're now in?
Well, I think your first part of saying that there's an openness now, that's what I've come to think about right off the bat. I lived through 9/11 in New York City, and I remember the conversations I had as a pastor in New York City right after 9/11. People formally would ask me, you know, what did I do? And I'd tell them that I was a pastor, and they'd sort of look at me like I was suddenly a bear in the zoo. You know, kind of interesting, but not necessarily something they wanted to interact with after that. Not scary, by the way, a nice little furry, cuddly bear or something. But then after 9/11, it was like, wow, I bet that really is important. You know, it's like all of a sudden the idea of caring for people's soul, however that was understood, was significant. And I think there's a lot of that occurring right now. I think the idea of this virus, which kind of comes like Batman, you know, I just saw a scene from Batman Begins where this gang of bad guys is like, there's 30 of them in the dark and Batman attacks them from the dark one at a time and they don't know who's going to get it next. You know, that feels like this coronavirus. We just don't know who's going to be next because of its incredible communicability, right? We can get it from all kinds of sources very quickly. So there's a sense, I think, of vulnerability and, you know, a reality of death, frankly, that I think without undermining the pain that people are really feeling, we have always known that death is a part of our life as Christians. And we're talking about this around the season of Easter. And I was struck in reflecting on that this season that we're going to be talking about the resurrection and new life in light of death all over, right? But that the Christian church has always done that. Many, many centuries we've had pandemics like the Black Plague of the 1300s. Currently, there's, you know, 250 million Christians that live in extreme persecution, which is, of course, not a natural, but it's a political pressure. But it's in a way, I think, that vulnerability and recognition of our mortality that gives us this incredible ability to know that the proclamation that Jesus Christ is risen today is powerful. So I haven't gotten to the questions to pose to people, but I think those, I think, are the places that make questions more interesting for people. The one that I think they understand what the ministry of the church is about, even if they don't fully grasp all the depths of it. And I think they also understand, you know, a more real way that death can come to any of us at any time. I mean, I think what I would want to ask is out of that for people who are outside the church, in a way, it's not particularly a scientific question, but, you know, how do you understand your own life and your values in light of this? Helping people explore what they've been living for. And I know this was the kind of thing that brought me to faith, not a virus, but the sense of, did the values that I lived for, were they deeply meaningful? Did they actually produce the deeper values I wanted, like love and intention and care for others? I think this is a time where we can really begin to think about that. I think of the work that my wife Laura does with the homeless in Chico. And, you know, can we care for those who, because of the financial implications of COVID-19, have been placed on the margins? Can we continue to care for them in a way? And for the people who are losing their jobs right now, right? Almost every American has been affected economically by this. So I think that's critically important. My main gig outside of the work at Chico State is with Science for the Church. I would be asking churches, who are those scientists in your midst that you can maybe leverage, if you want to use that term, to bring out insights into how to respond to this coronavirus outbreak? I'm going to be interviewing in a couple of weeks a strong Christian at Seattle Pacific University and a biochemist, Ben McFarland, who's used his expertise in his church to help them understand in the epicenter right there in Seattle, right, of this outbreak in Kirkland specifically, how is this coronavirus, what is it, how does it spread, how can we respond, what is a loving Christian way to respond? For churches asking, how are you engaging your Christian leaders who are scientists in this pandemic? So those are a few questions that come to mind. And I've seen some really profound ways those questions have been posed and responded to.
Well, I so much admire the work that you've been doing over all these years and the way that it seems to me to have both this deep historical and philosophical, theological underpinnings, but it also now lands in real time and space in the midst of an international crisis, unlike anything this generation or several generations before us have even experienced, if ever. And it shows up in a certain way. It magnifies, as you were saying earlier, certain things that were already there, but now become exaggerated or exacerbated by the tension that's put on the system. And it suddenly causes us to ask maybe a familiar set of questions, or maybe for some of us, an entirely new set of questions about how do I really understand the character of life? And what am I doing in light of what I think I believe or know? And what does it lead me toward? And I certainly want to just acknowledge how important it is, I think, that the church in general and your work in particular is an example of trying to keep doing this foundational work about how do we live as material spiritual beings and how do we understand, therefore, the relationship between a certain aspect of how material life is examined, namely through the biological sciences, alongside a spiritual quest that now raises a new kind of level of spiritual importance and implications as we try to do the ordinary things of just staying alive, staying sequestered in our homes, wherever those may be, or no homes, as many are sadly experiencing it. So I just want to say thank you for what you've done. Thank you for this conversation. And that I certainly hope that people will check out Science for the Church and all the things that are going on in that world. Also BioLogos and its great materials, the interview that we referred to earlier. So thank you, Greg. All the best and God bless you in this season and on.
Thank you so much for letting me be part of this ongoing conversation that you do so well. Thank you so much for this time and God bless you as well in this season, this COVID-19 world in which we live that still has the deep presence of Jesus Christ in it.
Amen. You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.